According to a poll by Monmouth University, 42% of Americans say they support the U.S. spending billions on programs destined for the moon, Mars, and asteroids. But a large share of the public, 50%, oppose spending that kind of money in outer space. Professor Chris Impey is a believer in human space exploration.
The possibility to set up an offshoot of the human civilization, a self-selected group of people who are willing to take the enormous risk to jump into the unknown, to be that first self-sufficient, self-starting colony elsewhere, that is as dramatic as only one event in human history, when we left Africa 50,000 years ago and radiated across the world.
On this week's Eastern Standard, Our Future in Space, a special presentation featuring Chautauqua lecturer Professor Chris Impey, a program recorded at the Hummel Planetarium on the EKU campus. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the Hummel Planetarium on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. Instead of our usual interactive live program on Thursday morning, we are recording this program a day in advance. This week's show taking place at the Hummel Planetarium with a very special guest, Professor Chris Impey. We have a number of people here with us at the planetarium, and we're going to invite them to be part of the conversation. As a matter of fact, our guests are here from the Honors Class, Honors 316, Seeing Science in Appalachia, taught by Dr. Martin Brock and Dr. Bill Stadden. And Physics 202, Dr. Tony Blows. Thank you, professors, and thank you, students, for being here. Actually, folks, feel free to let us know that you're in the room. Let us, maybe we can hear from everybody here, let you know that you're here. Thank you so much for being with us at the Hummel Planetarium. Professor Chris Impey is University Distinguished Professor and Deputy Head of the Astronomy Department at the University of Arizona. His research has been supported by $18 million in grants from NASA and the National Science Foundation, and he's had 24 projects given time on astronomy's premier research facility, the Hubble Space Telescope. Chris is also an author, having written many books on space. His most recent book, Beyond Our Future in Space, was chosen as an editor's choice book by the New York Times. Chris Impey is here to discuss the topic, What If We Live Off Earth? Exploring Our Future in Space, as he visits EKU to deliver a lecture as part of the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series. Chris Impey, thank you. Welcome to WEKU. Welcome to Kentucky and to the campus of Eastern Kentucky University.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to our conversation.
You have mentioned in the past that you believe humans are driven to explore space. Can you kick our conversation off by talking about what you mean by that?
Sure. I mean, on the face of it, it seems like an unlikely thing to do. There are only less than 600 people have been in Earth orbit or left the Earth's gravity, and that's 10 times less than the number of people who've stood on Mount Everest. So it's a pretty special thing, but geneticists have identified a gene, a variant of a gene called DRD4, that is correlated with risk-taking behavior, with ADHD, some things that are not necessarily helpful. And so that gene there's very clever work that's been shown that gene and the incidence of that gene correlates with how far our human ancestors migrated on the planet. In other words, more prevalence of that variant of a gene the further you travel. So we seem to have identified a genetic component to exploration or risk-taking behavior, which led us, when we left Africa, to travel around the whole planet in a very short time.
You mentioned how humans may evolve as we move off Earth. I assume that you're saying that evolution is part of what has happened historically in the exploration that we've done on the planet. How do you see humans evolving as space exploration becomes more possible?
Yeah, as humans live off Earth, and especially if there's a colony that's self-contained and not replenished by new people from the Earth, then the gene pool will be finite. And in biology, when there's a small population going through a bottleneck, it's called a population bottleneck, genetic diversity increases and evolution accelerates. So ironically, having a small population of colonists of the Moon or Mars will accelerate their evolution. And because they're in a different physical environment, subject to different gravity and artificial conditions, the way they evolve will diverge from what people on Earth experience. So this could happen fairly quickly.
Some of us grew up with an expectation that humans were going to space, that we were going to explore space. Some of us actually heard President Kennedy's inaugural address, "We choose to go to the moon." I guess that is where he made that statement. And we went to the moon in less than a decade. And then we've gone not very far beyond. We've done very little in terms of human exploration of space. Let's talk about your perceptions of what has happened in American politics, in American society, and I guess in global society that has stopped us from going any farther. 1969 is when we first went to the moon, and we've not yet been to Mars. We've not yet been to other planets or any other bodies in the solar system.
Right. And it's this sense of possibility driven by technology, and yet the fact that it doesn't seem like we've been doing very much that made me interested in writing a book about this subject. My research is in cosmology, which is really objects that are billions of light years away, so space is pretty close for a subject for a book. But you're right, it's a distant memory. None of the students in the audience were alive when we stood on the moon. Their parents were young kids watching grainy black and white TV images of Apollo astronauts, and as we probably know, in various polls by Pew and Gallup and so on, one in 10 or 12 Americans don't think we went there, think it's a hoax, the whole Apollo program. And that obviously ties into various conspiratorial mindsets of a fraction of the American public. But it's kind of amazing that it's so long ago that either most Americans were not alive when it happened, that's just simply a fact, or that some people think it didn't happen. And the why is interesting. So I think the why starts with the fact that space is hard. Liberating anything like a human body or a big rocket from Earth's gravity costs an enormous amount of energy. If you ever saw a picture of the Saturn V rocket that took the astronauts to the moon, it's huge. It's the size of the Statue of Liberty. And the little capsule at the top is 5% of the mass. So you're basically burning 90% or so of the mass of a huge rocket of just fuel just to extract three people from Earth's gravity. So it's very expensive and difficult. That's one reason. The second reason is that the Apollo program and the early space program was an anomaly, maybe hopefully a historical anomaly, because it was driven by a superpower rivalry, and it was a byproduct of an intense military competition stemming from the Cold War. We can remember that the architect of Apollo, the Saturn V rocket, was Wernher von Braun, who in an earlier time was designing V-2 rockets that rained death on London and other parts of Europe during the Second War, working for Hitler. And so that technology was used for pure military purposes. And when he was secreted back to the U.S. and his Nazi past sanitized, that's a slightly unpalatable part of the story, he became the architect of Apollo. But right through the 60s, we were in a pretty intense rivalry with the Soviet Union. We were worried about nuclear weapons in space. And so the motivation for the early part, even that glorious part of the going to the moon, the initial motivation was something a little more like fear and military rivalry, which I hope in the long view will turn out to be an anomaly.
So what happened? I mean, hadn't we not been able to take, say, the vision of Star Trek, for instance, which was a vision of a planet of people who got along and had a governing body, I assume, of people who are working toward bettering themselves and uniting for common purposes? Some of us, again, that's in that same era of the lunar exploration, we had that kind of science fiction occurring that seemed to be looking to the better qualities of humankind, and science fiction seemed to be, and science seemed to be tied to the better qualities as to maybe supersede and overcome the militarism and the political global rivalries. I mean, Where did all of that spirit go? Was it just not sincere and just never happened? That's why it never actually blossomed and became what we expected?
I think that spirit has always survived and coexisted, but it's been a little smaller than the main activity. The best thing, so some things we got right, and I'll give we should all give great credit to Eisenhower, president from the 1950s, for making NASA a civilian space agency. I don't think he often gets his due for this, but he was a general, obviously one of the primary components of victory in the Second World War, and he was extremely nervous about space being militarized, and he was under enormous pressure from the military, his former part of the services, to make a space agency that would further American military goals. And he resisted that. And so in 1959, when NASA was founded, it was Eisenhower's influence, you know, as president, basically, called the shot to say that it was a civilian space agency, not doing military research, open and transparent, for the good of mankind, for exploration, for development. So NASA's brand, its imprimatur from the beginning, did subscribe to that vision. And most of the people I've ever met that work for NASA, they have a bit of that kid in them that watched Star Trek, that got off on the science fiction and was buying into that vision. But remember, NASA's budget even now is $18 billion. Sounds like a lot of money. The U.S. military's budget is $600 or $700 billion. Sorry, I mean billion in both cases. So the military enterprise is still a much larger thing than the civilian space enterprise. So NASA's been a relatively small player in the American budget. There's slightly less than half a cent of your tax dollar goes to NASA and space exploration. Most people, if they're asked the question open-ended, think it's like 5% or something. So they overestimate by a factor of 10 how much we spend. So part of the fact that the vision has taken a long time to deliver is that it's a hard thing to do, and we're not actually spending that much money on it. But things have moved forward. It's just been a little slow. And of course, the big new game changer, which is what made me interested in writing a book and partly why I'm here and giving a talk tomorrow, is the commercial sector, the private sector, has now become a big player in space exploration, and that wasn't true at all for the entire history.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Professor Chris Impey is our guest. What If We Live Off Earth? Exploring Our Future in Space is the title of a Chautauqua lecture that Professor Impey is in Kentucky to deliver. And we're going to ask Professor Impey to tell us a little bit about his approach to the talk that he's going to offer on campus. But you seem to be someone interested, of course, in space exploration and encouraging such. What do you think we need to do? What beyond writing a book, beyond presentations and your teaching efforts, what can we do in our society to revitalize an interest in space exploration?
I think in some sense the momentum of the current private space exploration is such that we don't need to do much, because there's an enormous amount of investment coming from private sources into exploration. Now, those companies, of course, are motivated by profits. They're not interested in the altruistic goals of space or exploration for its own sake, but I think they're going to carry along a larger activity. Just look at the history of the internet, where it was originally incubated by the military-industrial complex, and the only people who had email were university professors or research institute people. And then 1995, Amazon, internet service providers, and now it's the private sector that runs the internet and create this trillion-dollar economy from it. The similar thing might happen in space in the future.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. We're going to take a short break and return. We are originating this week's program recorded at the Hummel Planetarium on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. We have an audience of 50, 60 people or so, and some folks from the community, but some students who are members of Honors 316, Seeing Science in Appalachia, and the Physics 202 class on the EKU campus. And we're going to hear from them with their questions and their comments as we return with Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Hello, I'm John Hingsberg, and this week's program is a special edition of the show recorded at the Hummel Planetarium on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University with our guest, Professor Chris Impey. Chris is also an author, a University Distinguished Professor of Astronomy at the University of Arizona, Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, And his book, his most recent book, Beyond Our Future in Space. And Professor Chris Impey, we're here to talk about space exploration and actually the potential for human colonization of space. Is that really where you're going in your book, Our Future in Space?
Yes. I think, despite what we were talking about, that it's a generation or more since we stood on the moon, the technology for having a moon base or a Mars base exists. It's a lot more expensive to do it on Mars than the moon, so I actually think we'll start on the moon. And there are people motivated to do that. It could happen through NASA or other space agencies, but it might well happen through the private sector.
When is it going to happen? Will those of us of a certain age, the baby boom generation, for instance, who were excited by space exploration, will we get to see the fruition of any of that? Or is it going to be 30, 40, 50 years away?
I think it'll happen on the moon, say, within 10 or 15 years, and Mars probably 20 to 25 years. NASA has a time frame like that, and I think the private sector similar. Now, those will initially be very small colonies resupplied with rotating members every few years. A fully self-sustained, autonomous colony, that may be 30 or 40 years away.
Do we, the United States, does NASA even have launch vehicles and the ability to place humans in space at this point? I mean, aren't we doing it all through the Russians?
That's right. And since the last shuttle flight in 2011, America has not had the ability to put an astronaut in Earth orbit, which is, and we depend on the Russians, who, as you may have noticed, we're not getting on that well with. So that's been very awkward for 5 years and an embarrassment, to be honest, for America. The Space Launch System, a much morphed, much changed, much delayed heavy lift capability, is due to be tested next year and the year after. So America may be about 2 years away from recapturing the ability to put astronauts in orbit.
Are there other nations developing this technology to place humans
there
in
are,
space?
There are, and also, as we've all probably read, SpaceX, the Elon Musk operation, is also planning to put astronauts into orbit. So there are American private companies that are planning to do this, even if the government can't. Meanwhile, yes, the Russians have always had the capability. They use essentially a 55-year-old Proton rocket, the same one they used during the Apollo era to put to the Soyuz capsule into orbit. That's who we rely on now. And the Chinese have a capability, quite a growing capability.
We recently, just in the last week or so, observed the 30th anniversary of the Challenger explosion, mm-hmm. Which was a very moving event for many of us. Has travel to space become safer since that tragedy?
I did this research for this for my book, and the total fatality rate in space is about 2%. Now, that's a lot worse than driving a car or flying an airplane, but it's actually no, if you happen to fly wingsuits for a living, the dangerous recreational occupation, that fatality rate is 5 or 10%. So it's actually no more dangerous than some of the things we do recreationally on the Earth. And it's not got any worse. It's got safer, actually.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Professor Chris Impey is with us. He is here to deliver a Chautauqua lecture on the topic, What If We Live Off Earth? Exploring Our Future in Space. We are at the Hummel Planetarium on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. We have students with us from an Honors 316 class and from Physics 202, and some members of the community who've responded to our invitation to come in and join us for the program. And we have our first question from the audience. Step forward. Why don't you give us your first name? Tell us a little whatever you want to tell us about yourself and ask your question.
I'm Austin. I'm from the Honors 316 class. And I was wondering, you said that the private sector is putting forth a lot of investment towards the space program, and they would do that for profit. So what kind of profit can be made from space exploration?
Okay. It's good to meet you, Austin. I think there are significant profits. I can answer this a couple of ways. SpaceX and Orbital Sciences, which are the two private companies that have been ferrying supplies to the space station, they each have multi-billion-dollar contracts from NASA and therefore the federal government to do that work. So they are already making, significant amounts of money to resupply the space station. Both of those companies want to improve their launch capability to take astronauts up and down, and they'll charge for that. And they will make a decent profit. The true cost accounting price of a shuttle launch when they you know, you get below the layers of it, was about $500 million per shuttle launch. That's really expensive. So it seems like the private sector can do the job cheaper and still make a profit. So that's one part of the answer. They're making money right now. And the second part of the answer is that the model based on tourism is a viable economic model. Richard Branson's company, Virgin Galactic, that had a disaster 18 months ago, loss of a pilot. So they're not, you know, they have some work to do to get their safety up. But they've taken over $150,000, they've taken a lot of money, maybe 150 deposits of $200,000 each for people who wanted suborbital joyride. And so they have a business model based on essentially a 6-minute zero gravity joyride into space. And there's this Hollywood A-list of people who put their money down for it. And interestingly, when the Spaceship Two was lost with the death of a pilot a year or so ago, Richard Branson offered all those people who put down deposits their money back if they got cold feet. And I think he only gave back a couple of deposits. So the people who want to do this, even recreationally, understand there's some risk. And so he's confident he has a business model, too.
Thank you, Austin, for stepping forward with your question. And we have another member of the audience stepping forward. Professor Chris Impey is our guest for this week's Eastern Standard. We're at the Hummel Planetarium on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. And, of course, we encourage you to follow our program on Twitter, at WEKUEST. You'll find that we have posted information about this week's program, as we do every show, on the WEKU Facebook page, so you can offer some comments after the program if you like as well, if you're listening to the program on Thursday morning or the Sunday evening repeat. Thank you for being with us. Ma'am, step forward and identify yourself.
Hello, I'm Ann. I'm a professor in the Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy Department. And I was very interested, Professor Impey, to read that you had been to Nepal or Tibet to teach the monks science. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you have a few gems that you could share about intersecting cosmologies or views of the Earth and the universe.
Sure. Yes, I've had the privilege since 2008 to go to India essentially every year to teach Tibetan monks cosmology. It's a program started by the Dalai Lama in 2000 to train his monks and nuns for the 21st century, because the monastic curriculum in Buddhism hasn't typically had much math and science. So I've been going there, and it's an incredible experience. If I were going to just connect, I mean, there are so many good things about going there, it's hard to pick one. But if I was going to at least connect to our topic today, I would say that, the monks and nuns, you know, they don't know much about space travel. So when we talk about that, it's another realm. And so the best we can do, sitting in a small, dingy classroom in northern India where the power goes out all the time and there's no internet, it's pretty basic and rudimentary existence, is we do visualization. So here, knowing that they're good at meditation, of course, I've been doing it now regularly. The first time was a bit of an adventure. I sort of get them to go into a meditative state, and then I talk them out of their bodies and out into a low Earth orbit situation, and then beyond to look at the solar system, and then beyond to see the galaxy below them like a pinwheel, and then beyond to the I do a guided visualization of the universe with them. And, you know, it seems a little new agey, a little hokey, whatever, but they completely buy it. They completely get into it. And maybe the most poignant thing I would say about that is when I bring them back down into their bodies after this adventure, we debrief a little and I hear their experiences. And one monk got very quiet when he was talking about what he experienced. And he had to be prodded by his buddies to talk, because he seemed pretty melancholy. And he said, well, I came back down towards the earth and I was hovering over the Tibetan plateau, because we were on the edge of the Himalayas. And he said, and I saw my home, Tibet, a place he'd never seen since he was 5. And he said, I wanted to go home. So it's a pretty amazing experience teaching the monks. Thanks for the question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anne, for being with us. This is Eastern Standard, and we are at the Hummel Planetarium recording this week's program with Professor Chris Impey and students from Eastern Kentucky University in the audience. Feel free, anyone who's in the audience, to step forward if you have a question for Professor Chris Impey. You are the callers for this week's program, and we're grateful for your attendance. About, about 60 people in our audience. They're being very quiet, and we'll ask them to make some noise perhaps at least at some point during the program. Once again, Professor Chris Impey, I'm actually the question about working with monks and nuns raises a question of some stereotypes about scientists and geeky type people who are interested in space exploration, who are focused on some maybe in their own world in the stereotype of some people. I think of the TV show The Big Bang Theory, mm-hmm. the characters in that program who are highly intelligent but maybe not always very realistic and not very down to earth. Why is space travel and this kind of concern about science? Why do you believe, I assume you believe, that it helps make us into more balanced and better human beings, thinking beyond ourselves and thinking in these high levels of science?
Yeah, it's a good question. Actually, there's a lot there that I could comment on, because the issue of, you know, stereotypes in science or even in space, they're real, and they have an origin that has pretty much maybe excluded, not overtly, but indirectly excluded people from the activity. And I think you just have to go back to that origin of the space program as an offshoot of the Cold War and a rivalry with the Soviet Union. So the first thing to remember is that the prototypical astronauts, the Wright stuff, the Mercury, the Gemini, and the Apollo astronauts were essentially a monoculture. They were all white men from the Midwest, to be blunt. Ohio has generated more astronauts than any other state.
Neil Armstrong, John Glenn, yeah, to name a couple.
And in fact, one of the latter Ohio astronauts was on the Colbert Show back when he had his show. And Colbert's first question to him, what is it about Ohio that makes everyone want to escape?
Wapakoneta, Ohio.
So the astronauts were a monoculture, and so it took a while for women to be astronauts. The first astronaut of color only happened within the last decade. And then in the margins, the same thing. Sally Ride, who's rightly famous as the first woman American astronaut, the first woman astronaut, of course, was a Russian woman very early in the space program. Sally Ride was gay, and she essentially asked to keep that hidden until she died because she didn't feel that it would be accepted. So you get a sense here of the participation of women and people of color and other minorities, if you like, that it's not been a welcoming thing. I have a little anecdote from my own acquaintance with Laurie Anderson. Laurie Anderson is a performance artist and musician living in New York. She's quite well known. And she got invited to be NASA's first artist in residence. So NASA boldly went interdisciplinary with an artist in residence program about a decade ago. And she was the first and last artist in residence. It just didn't work. Their culture, their bureaucratic part of their culture, was not very admitting of artists and musicians and didn't really understand how they worked. And Laurie Anderson telling me about this, she sort of laid it out. She said on the first day of her tenure as artist in residence, she was in the office of the mission director at Houston Space Center, where they launched the astronauts, where they trained the astronauts. And she sat across from him and she was all bright-eyed and she said, "Well, when do I go up?" And, you know, that was the beginning of the end, because of course she wasn't going to go up. They were never going to send her up. And so I think NASA missed a trick over the years, because they never sent poets and artists and philosophers and people who had different ways of thinking about the world and their place in it. They sent people who were engineers and test pilots, and that's fine. So I think that there's a picture here where when the private sector takes over or does their thing, that's going to be good, because normal people, regular people, okay, initially they'll have to be quite rich, but eventually not so rich, will go up and space will become for everyone.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Let's turn back to our audience here at the Hummel Planetarium on the EKU campus. And sir, thank you for being with us, and identify yourself and go right ahead.
My name's Hayden. I'm in the Physics 202 class. My question is, how realistic and how important do you feel like asteroid mining will be to the future of space exploration?
Okay, thanks, Hayden. That's a good question, because you hear things about commercial proposition. So it's another part of the commercialization of space. If tourism and recreation is a viable business model, what about mining asteroids?
There are minerals on those asteroids that we want.
Well, there are enormous mineral wealth on asteroids. So there's a little disconnect, though. So if you take a near-Earth asteroid that's maybe 500 meters across, not that big, and easy to find those, and you can actually, by spectroscopy with telescopes, you can pretty much identify this composition and pick asteroids that have the high metal content or rare earths or things that you want. So if you do that and find one that's coming near to the Earth anyway, you're, by numbers, you're talking about $2 trillion, maybe $3 trillion worth of mineral resources. Substantial, you know, enough to get any businessman or entrepreneur excited. So that's real. That's a legitimate calculation. But then you have to work out the cost of extraction and bringing the materials down to Earth. And that's the part that people haven't done yet. The cost of lassoing the asteroid into an Earth orbit, slowing it down, mining it in place, and getting the materials down to Earth. People still think the sheer number on that wealth is such that they think it's viable, but nobody's worked it out. There's a big business model that hasn't been built yet. So at the moment, I think the jury is out on that. But there are enough people interested. And if you just think about the history of, you know, exploration of the American West or Australia, places with great mineral resources, there were people who just took chances. You know, they lost fortunes and they made fortunes. And I think asteroid mining is going to be that on an even larger scale.
Another question, Hayden?
Just as a follow-up, how do you feel like the possibility of a space elevator?
Yeah, that's a great idea too. So Arthur C. Clarke, who was mentioned in the video as having anticipated telecommunications 50 years before it happened, he said he was asked, when will we get space elevators? And he said 50 years after people stopped laughing. So, you know, and he understood that people thought it was a visionary technology. So the short answer is space elevator, which is essentially a cable tethered on the Earth's surface and then just free-floating in space to the point where its weight is balanced by centrifugal force of the spinning planet, so it just hovers like an Indian rope trick. That's possible on the moon right now with current technologies, with carbon nanotube composites. They have enough tensile strength. On the Earth, it's not possible. We'd have to develop new materials. So the engineers and the studies I've seen say there are no showstoppers to doing it on the moon. It will cost $10 to $15 billion. That's a rough estimate, but as a consortium enterprise, that's a tenth of what the space station has cost to this point. So again, I think space elevators, initially on the moon, maybe within 15 years, are completely possible.
And these are elevators that would be based on the moon,
right,
from the moon's surface, not from the Earth's
surface. And the motivation,
surface.
Just to give the motivation, is that once you have this elevator, you've constructed it, you can travel with solar-powered elevator cars, bring things into zero gravity free, without all that rocket fuel, that expense of the rocket fuel we were talking about.
Chris Impey is our guest on this week's Eastern Standard. He is in Richmond, Kentucky to provide a Chautauqua lecture on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, What If We Live Off Earth? Exploring Our Future in Space. And he's our guest on this week's Eastern Standard, program recorded at the Hummel Planetarium on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. We'll be right back.
Our whole universe was in a hot, dense state that nearly 14 billion years ago expansion started. Wait, the Earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool, Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall. We built the pyramids, math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a big bang.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. This week's topic, What If We Live Off Earth? Exploring Our Future in Space. Chris Impey is the Chautauqua Lecture guest on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University discussing that very topic, and he joined us for a program here at the Hummel Planetarium on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. We have in the audience Honors 316 and Physics 202 from Eastern Kentucky University. Thank you all for being here with us, about 50, 60 students here and a couple of other folks from the Richmond community, perhaps beyond, with us for this week's program. We have a couple of folks who've been waiting patiently with their questions, so please step forward, identify yourself, sir, and go right ahead.
My name is Thomas. I'm a physics major here at the Eastern Kentucky University, and my question was Just to ask if you could elaborate a little bit about the logistical challenges of, say, a Mars mission versus a moon mission, because we have kind of an idea now what to expect with a moon mission, but Mars is much farther away and a much longer.
You mean just for the first human visit or for habitation and colonies?
Both.
Yeah. The logistics of Mars are extremely difficult compared to the moon. Moon, we've done it before. It's a week away. Mars, on the most energy-efficient orbit, is 8 months away. So your first issue is you're having to subsist in a very confined environment for 8 months. You're subject to a lifetime of radiation dose, cosmic rays, high-energy radiation. So, you know, the cancer risk of the Mars visitors is going to be significant, and they will just accept that as the risk. And selecting people who can withstand that level of isolation in a close environment is quite challenging. And also the psychological issue of being so far from home, of really being probably beyond a rescue mission.
Despite the recent film.
Yes, I like the film and I like the book. I read the book before I saw the film. I like both. But yes, until we've got a bigger enterprise built up, the rescue mission's not going to be there. So these first, you know, it costs so much. So I think the first colonists or first visitors are going to be on their own. So the logistics are quite complicated. And what it's going to involve is a series of unmanned missions to lay the groundwork. So the first, and we of course have rovers there already and landers, and that's going to continue. And then the next decade, those landers and rovers are going to start doing the groundwork, the legwork for a human visit. And so what they're going to do is identify the best place for that visit. They're going to deploy the materials that would be needed to build the habitat, and these are obviously going to be self-inflating bubble domes. They're going to be deploying things like 3D printers that will be used to make building materials, because you do have to cover your bubble dome with slump block, essentially made from the soil, to protect yourself from the radiation. You're going to drop on the Mars surface various little chemical mining facilities that are small. They're that can extract oxygen from the soil and water from the soil. So the Martian soil, a cubic meter has about a liter of water, and that's quite a lot from a cubic meter, and it has oxygen, and you can use the oxygen to breathe and to make rocket fuel. So the advanced work will deploy those technologies on the surface. So when the astronauts get there, all the stuff they need is nearby. Now, clearly there are going to be issues, you know. If everything went smoothly, that would be actually amazing. So there's an enormous amount of thought that's going to go into this, as well as to picking the location. What's the best location? Because if you go to the cost, and let's put a number on the cost, it's going to be about $100 billion to send humans to Mars. They better bring back some interesting information, scientific research. So you're going to have to pick a very interesting part of Mars, probably a place, I would guess, where you think life may exist under the surface, where there's an aquifer. You know, we know water can't be on the surface of Mars now, but it could be underground under pressure with some heat from below. So the Martian astronauts finding life under the surface would be, you know, a magnificent achievement that would make it all worthwhile. So there's a lot that's going to go into this.
Are we actually going to Mars? Are we working to make that happen?
Yeah.
Do we have the $100 billion budgeted someplace?
No, but NASA's forward look, you know, NASA gets dinged for not being visionary enough, and indeed, There seem like times when they haven't been very visionary. I mean, the space shuttle lost 2 out of 5 and was sort of a space truck, supposed to go at once a week, never went more than 14 times in a year. But NASA's forward look does include these first human visitors to Mars in the 20-year to mid 2030s. So it's in NASA's plan. So NASA's problem is easy to put. Their budget is $18.5 billion. Sounds like a lot of money. But when you take out the propulsion and rocket technology part, a lot of what NASA does is Earth-looking science, benefiting the Earth, not just outer space. The free energy, if you like, or the free chunk of their budget for any new thing is about $1 to $2 billion a year. It's a fraction of their budget, 10% of their budget. And so you have to build a wedge of funding and then grow that wedge to do anything that's going to cost $50 or $60 billion. And they're planning on that because they're talking 20 years out. So. But remember, NASA has a budget that fluctuates according to political fortune. They work on an election cycle. The Chinese have a space program whose budget's growing with the rate of their economy. They're doing very well. Their government is completely committed to a moon base. to a space station, to various other things. And so the political will in China, quite different situation, is actually stronger than it is here. And that's of NASA's problem.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. Professor Chris Impey is our guest for this week's program, originating from the Hubble Planetarium on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. We have some students here from Eastern Kentucky University.
Hello. My name's Love. I hope this question isn't too far off topic, but we were really curious as to whether or not you considered Pluto a planet.
Ah, okay. Well, Love, thanks for that question. Astronomers do get asked this a lot. And I was actually at the meeting, the international meeting a decade ago, where Pluto was voted down as a regular planet and consigned to dwarf planet status. So I, along with most of my colleagues in astronomy, do consider that Pluto, it does not have all the attributes of a planet, partly because of its orbital properties, its size, the fact that it doesn't dominate its zone of the solar system as the other planets do. And then that combined with the fact that there are likely to be Pluto or larger sized objects further out in the Kuiper Belt. And we've been reading in the last few weeks about the incipient discovery of something much larger than Pluto, much further out than Pluto. So for the people who, the biggest concern comes from letters from third graders saying you took away our favorite planet. It happens to be a Disney character too, so that's like very cruel. Would you rather third graders have to remember, one less planet, but if you throw in these other planets, they may have to remember the names of four or five other things that are soon going to be discovered. So most astronomers are okay with Pluto not being a planet.
You have a guess of how many planets we're going to end up accepting into our solar system?
If we draw the line at Pluto size, I think it's going to be another four or five.
Okay.
And they'll be discovered in the next five or so years.
So we can get some new planetary charts for our classrooms eventually. Thank you for your question.
Hi, I'm back again.
Again, your name again?
Austin.
Austin, thank you.
Yeah, since I got the go-ahead for weird questions, I gotta ask. Yeah. I feel like this should be on everybody's mind. Do you believe in aliens?
Ah, okay.
Life beyond the planet
so,
Earth.
So astronomers, okay, with Pluto, astronomers are in a tough position because we're either being forced to follow scientific principles or be cruel to children. with aliens, it's another interesting question because astronomers do not believe that UFO sightings or abductions are what they represent to be, the visits to the Earth of an intelligent species from beyond our solar system. And they don't believe it because the evidence is not compelling. Carl Sagan once said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And the extraordinary evidence that would be required to believe that would be some form of physical evidence that could be passed around labs and verified independently. In the digital age, photos mean nothing. If you've ever talked to lawyers or been a lawyer, you know that eyewitness testimony is about the most unreliable thing you can imagine. So those are not sufficient. But astronomers are also aware that the census from the Kepler spacecraft has told us that there are 100 million Earth-like and therefore habitable planets in the Milky Way, just in our galaxy. And the odds that they were all dead, or that none of them evolved intelligent life, seem very small. So astronomers are in the interesting situation that they believe that the evidence is suggestive of intelligent life in the galaxy somewhere, even though it might be rare, but they don't believe that we've already been visited. And so the way to reconcile those two is to say that the intelligent life is quite rare and recognize the Milky Way is really big. Space is big, and it's hard to travel through, as we're finding out. And so that we just, even if they exist, we maybe haven't been visited just because of the difficulties of space, time, and energy.
On this week's Eastern Standard, we are talking with Professor Chris Impey. Chris is speaking as part of the Chautauqua Lecture Series on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, What If We Live Off Earth? Exploring Our Future in Space. I'm John Hingsberg, and my job is very easy this week because we have some excellent questions coming from students from Eastern Kentucky University, members of two classes of Physics 202 and Honors 316, I believe it is, and they're stepping forward with questions. Thank you for being with us. Go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Wendy, and I'm from the Honors 316 class, and you've spoken that you definitely believe colonization of the moon and Mars is possible, but what are the gains involved in that? Because I know personally I wouldn't want to go to Mars and possibly get like radiation exposure, so why would humans want to do that?
Right. It's a very personal thing. So you may have heard of a company called Mars One out of Holland. Blas Landorp is a you know, not maybe not a billionaire, but he's a venture capitalist in Holland, and he's proposing a privately funded venture to make Mars colonies happen within a decade. Most engineers don't really think he can do it. He doesn't have the technical wherewithal. But to your question, when he put out the call, and you may have seen this on the web, he got the tens of thousands of people signing up for what is out of the gate a one-way trip. He's never pretended that they're going to bring people back because it's twice as expensive to bring you back as to take you. And he got, and even if many of them were not serious, he's now winnowed down to 1,000 and now to a few hundred that are in early stages of training. If there are tens of thousands of people willing to sign up for a one-way trip to Mars, then clearly people are going to want to do it. And if you just analogize with exploration of the Earth, people, you know, the first Arctic and Antarctic explorers died. I mean, most of them, the death rate from those early ventures a century ago was very high. The death rate for the first climbing of Everest and the major peaks was high, you know, 30%, 20%. So the people who want to do something extraordinary are essentially willing to risk death. Elon Musk, the CEO of SpaceX, has said he wants to die on Mars. He doesn't have the kind of sense of humor to lead you to think he's joking. He's probably serious. So I think it's a very personal thing. Okay, just to be a little bit of a Debbie Downer here, we're all going to die, right? And do you want to die? And there's a big way to die and a little way to die. And maybe for the people who do this, even the thought of going to Mars and knowing you're going to die there, maybe even before you become very old, is an amazing way to have lived a life. So I think that's the best. Now, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't sign up for the one-way trip. I'd love to visit, but that, I'm not in that one-way category.
Another question, Wendy? Sure, go right ahead.
Leading on from that question, what would life be like on Mars? I mean, what would you be doing? Would you just be hanging out, like, helping out? Like, what would you be doing?
I mean, so that's part of the reason I would hesitate. I mean, it'd be such an incredible thing to visit. But it's a good question, because life on Mars would be kind of, it'd be a little bit grim. I mean, you'd be trapped in a bubble dome with a small set of people who, if you were not getting on well with them, there's nowhere to go, right? The psychological stress of being that far from home and possibly beyond rescue and being cooped up with this set of people who you may have got on just great with during training on Earth, but suddenly you find out all their totally annoying habits and, you know, the toilet seat left open, kitchen left a mess, whatever, and there's nowhere to go. These are your people, right? It's like a biosphere. So you remember the biosphere experiment up the road from me, just a half hour's drive from where I work in southern Arizona. Biosphere was a nice big habitat with eight people supposed to be in there for 2 years. They were at war with each other within a month. You know, there were two factions of four that were at odds with each other, and that whole experiment, as you probably recall, unraveled. So the glory and the wonder of being on Mars, you know, that is going to be amazing, but in the end, you're in a human situation. So if it's for more than, you know, a few weeks or a month, you can tolerate almost anything. You can hang out with your family for a month, and you might go crazy, but, you know, it doesn't last forever. So, yeah, I think people don't quite estimate correctly how very hard it's going to be. If it's a colony, 100 or so people, minimum colony by genetic requirements would be about 150 people to make a genetic balanced gene pool. That's a different thing. That's a social group that's large enough that it would probably be okay. But the first totally closed in, small environment group of people, that's going to be a tough situation.
This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, and you are?
My name is Michael. I'm from the Physics 202 class. Austin's question about aliens got me a little curious. Since we are not at all sure that there is no life out there, do we have any program at all for defending Earth just in case they come to us?
It's a good question. And as you probably know, Stephen Hawking has argued that we shouldn't actively communicate because we shouldn't alert the aliens of superior capability, because they probably would be, to our existence. So unfortunately, the answer to your question is no, since it's almost a given that any alien technology or capability visiting us is more advanced than ours, we probably don't have the defenses against them. So that's a case where you probably wish we will be alone, at least in our part of the galaxy, because no, to superior technology, we'd probably be defenseless.
That is a fascinating question. Sorry, we don't have much more time. And let's get one more quick question on, and thank you for coming forward.
All right, this is Hayden again. One more question. So we've discussed the financial reasons that we would want to explore space, but are there other reasons that we would want to explore space, like continuing keeping the human race alive?
Yes, I think so there's the purely visionary exploration for its own sake purpose, and there's a piece of that. Now, that's not going to float the boat when it costs $100 billion, so we can acknowledge that that alone won't be sufficient. But the other reason I would give is, yes, that future visionary reason of colonization of off-Earth. So this is a good place to finish because this is the premise of my talk tomorrow. You know, we have problems on the Earth, and a lot of people who don't want to spend money on space exploration point to the problems we have feeding the planet and taking care of the planet and say, no, we should put our resources there. And I completely agree with that. But for a very small fraction of our resources, the possibility to set up an offshoot of the human civilization, a self-selected group of people who are willing to take the enormous risk to jump into the unknown, to be that first self-sufficient, self-starting colony elsewhere, that is as dramatic as only one event in human history, when we left Africa 50,000 years ago and radiated across the world. So, but it's more dramatic because we'll become a new species in a few hundred generations, as far as genetics can tell us. So that's an extraordinary event in human history. I mean, it's a singular event in human history, and why wouldn't we want to see how that plays out?
And with those comments, we will conclude our conversation with Professor Chris Impey. He is on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University to deliver a Chautauqua lecture, What If We Live Off Earth, Exploring Our Future in Space. We want to say thank you for being with us, and we want to thank our audience in attendance from Eastern Kentucky University, the Honors 316 class and Physics 202 class. Thank you all for being with us. I want to thank our producers for Eastern Standard for helping put together today's program. Producer for the show was Andrew Moorhead, and certainly thank you to Ida Bermudez, a planetarium educator, and James Hughes, senior planetarium system engineer on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. Eastern Standard is a production of Eastern Kentucky University, WEKU, on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University. More information about our program is online at weku.fm, and you can interact with us by Twitter at WEKUEST. This program repeats on Sunday evening. You can find a podcast and the ability to listen to this audio online from the website at weku.fm. Again, thank you once again, Professor Chris Impey, for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for your great questions and to the audience for your great questions.
Thank you all for being here with us for this week's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations.